I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Film Flam. And this week, we're going to be looking at probably the most famous and some consider the greatest Irish film ever made, The Quiet Man. Well, recently I saw a film called Dreaming the Quiet Man by Shane Mary Doyle, an excellent documentary, which hopefully will be on this Christmas. But if not, it's on Volta.ie, which I've told you about here before. And it's an amazing film, which just goes into showing how the film was made. Some of the kind of raunchy shenanigans that were going on between John Wayne and, well, John Ford, actually, and Maureen O'Hara. And some of the actual kind of the way it affected the people of Spittle and Connemara. And I think what's great about it is it actually shows you kind of the reality and a lot of the things that people don't actually talk about with The Quiet Man. And it has some great contributors like Martin Scorsese, Peter Bogdanovich, and even our own Jim Sheridan are in it. But the one accusation that's always made about this film is the stage Irishness. And I suppose this is something we're very sensitive even nowadays, you know, the drunken Paddy falling around the pub, which, you know, singing Wild Colonial Boy. And I suppose we are all, you know, kind of, you know, frightened that this film depicts us two American immigrants as kind of foolish and kind of so punchy and monkeys that the English depict us in the 19th century. And it is, you know, definitely because we are a colonized people, we feel that maybe this film is often dismissed as being part of that similar sort of thing, and that Americans, when they come over here, are looking for that kind of, you know, Irishness and corny leprechaun, you know, look about Ireland. But I don't think this film is part of that, mainly because John Ford was an Irish, you know, second generation Irishman himself, but he had a very complex relationship with Ireland that's often not looked at. And in fact, Kevin Rockett, in his book about Irish cinema, it says that in fact it uses a very Brechtian device, although I'd say John Ford would probably punch him in the face for, you know, using the word Brecht in his presence. But yeah, there is, you know, it is almost like a dream, I think this film is. And, you know, and even Shane Mary Doyle pays, you know, he talks about that in his film, that it is a dream. Quiet Man is a dream of Ireland. And we can sort of see that actually when you look at the film, like at the start and the end. At the start, when he first sees Maureen O'Hara, Barry Fitzgerald says, it's only a dream brought on by your thirst. And at the very end, we have also a sequence where, you know, everyone at the end of the film bows, which is a kind of, yeah, it is almost like people coming out behind the stage, behind the presidium arch or whatever, and bowing. So, you know, if you want to, like, is this film, in fact, like a David Lynch, you know, dream within a dream movie, like, you know, like some of his latter films? But, you know, that's, I don't know. I mean, it is interesting, but I think it is, it's still quite a naturalistic film. And the other thing I think a lot of people have problems with The Quiet Man is the sexism. You know, here's a stick to beat the lovely lady. And I think, I have problems with that as well myself, and that Maureen O'Hara is kind of almost seen as this kind of chattel that he can buy and sell, and he brings her back to her brother, and he, you know, it's all this argument about the dowry. But as Scorsese says in Dreaming the Quiet Man, this is because it's about a feudal society, and then in fact that this gave women a lot of empowerment in both Italian, or in our case, Irish society, and it's about that. And in fact, Maureen O'Hara is actually quite a, you know, one of the most memorable characters in the film, if not the most memorable character in the film, and she's not underfoot, and she's quite a strong woman. So I don't know if the sexism issue that a lot of people have with it is true either. The most intriguing aspect of the film, though, I think, is the Republican politics of the film and how this actually fed into not only into Ford's, you know, this film, but also all of his films, and especially the Westerns. And one of the things that's talked about in the documentary is about, in the 1920s, Ford actually came back to Ireland during the Irish War of Independence and actually saw his family in Connemara being burnt out. And this, I think, really, this image really resonated with him for years and years and years when he went back to America. And when we watched, like, the homesteads in, you know, in the prairies and the Westerns being burnt out in a lot of his films, especially, like, in The Searchers, it's not actually about the Comanches or whatever tribe, Indian tribe. It's actually about the black and tans. And this is a very intriguing aspect of John Ford that people don't know, that he was actually using the Western to express how he felt about how the British had treated the Irish, rather than, as a lot of people would claim, that his films are very racist towards Indians, and that what they're actually about is about, you know, the imperial thing that the Americans had going on against the Indians, but yeah, Arab against the Native Americans. So it's a very interesting film, not only The Quiet Man, but also how his Irish heritage went into making this film and other films. And he really did worship Ireland, like a lot of second generation Irish. You know, he taught about Ireland a lot. He you know, and you can sort of see it, that it was a place of tranquility in his mind, as it is for a lot of Americans. It's a place that, you know, when they think about Ireland, it's this wonderfully green, and in fact, you know, he graded the film to look very green. And then if you look at the other side of within the film, like if you think about the scene where when John Wayne is knocked out and we see America, it's the only scene actually set in America. It's black and white. There's like bulbs flashing off. It's very expressionistic style. It's very dark. It's almost like a horror scene. And I mean, I know it was very deeply influential on the way in which Raging Bull was shot. And it looks quite almost like a scene from Raging Bull. And it's a very extreme, kind of nasty kind of vision of America and then the greenness of Ireland. So, you know, when people, you know, this man is not, you know, he's not this kind of corny figure that people, a lot of people kind of, when they see John Wayne, he's this guy with an eye patch and he looks very nasty. But I really think he's quite a radical figure. I mean, like Hitchcock, beneath all this kind of corny exterior, this kind of, you know, tough guy, there was a lot of, you know, waters running deep, you know. And you know, a lot of people would actually kind of see him as having this very hokey comedy in all his films. And I think two of the films which actually don't have any of this hokey comedy were the only films he was actually nominated for an Oscars, and they were The Grapes of Wrath and How Green Was My Valley. And what's interesting about these is, if you want to talk about Ford as coming from an Irish background, these films were actually about immigrants as well. I mean, in the case of Grapes of Wrath, it's about immigrants in Depression-era America going from the Dust Bowl to California. And then... Also, it was looking at a kind of a Welsh coal mining village, which would have definitely been about his own family in How Green Was My Valley. These films have been such, everyone should watch Grapes of Wrath, because it's almost like happening now again in Ireland and everywhere else, where people are kind of being thrown out. And I do think, as an immigrant, as someone as part of the diaspora, he definitely, in these films, you know, showed what his politics were. And it's interesting, actually, that Grapes of Wrath was shot by Greg Tolland, who's one of the great cinematographers of all time, and he shot in a very deep focus style. Again, this expressionism that I keep going back to, that's in a lot of John Ford's films. And then later, Greg Tolland went on to shoot Citizen Kane, the great, you know, American expressionist movie, and the greatest movie of all time, a lot of people will claim. Orson Welles was in love with John Ford. I mean, he considered him like, you know, like he's the text of cinema for him. When he was making Citizen Kane, was The Fast Stagecoach, which he watched like hundreds of times to kind of, you know, find out about how filmmaking worked. And it's a great film, actually, Stagecoach, and it's probably his most basic film, you know, like in terms of it's great stunt work and a fine performance by John Wayne, you know, and starred in several films after him. And Wayne is kind of an interesting figure as well. People always consider Wayne as a very stiff kind of a tough guy, but in fact he was a dancer, and that very strange loose walk that he had was definitely very graceful, you know. And he wasn't just what people think of, this kind of gruff character, and there's a lot of ambiguity as well in the films he made with John Ford. I mean, just to take two of them which I think are very, very, very important, are The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, and that is a famous, you know, print the legend line, which is, this line a lot of people kind of get wrong, and they think it's actually just about, you know, the politics of violence, and, you know, Jimmy Stewart's character is this kind of effete, kind of townie, and then Wayne is this kind of hardy, kind of cowboy, and it's about, you know, about the politics of violence, that, you know, only tough guys can actually do it, and, you know, senators live out from that, and it's all about that kind of thing. But it's actually more about perspective, and it's a very complex film, really, when you watch it. And of course, the masterpiece, the film that has influenced everybody, and that is The Searchers. And it's an endlessly watchable film. I mean, if you've never seen a Western, I would definitely tell you to go see The Searchers, because it has, at the heart of it, has this very ambiguous figure played by John Wayne of Eton, who's like, you know, people will always think of him, again, it's this kind of simplistic view of John Ford, that it's about racism, that he wants to kill Natalie Wood's character because she's been taken in by a tribe. But I think this film, actually, at the end, he forgives her and he walks out to the doorway, and there's a famous shot where he's, again, like proscenium arch at the end of the film, where he's standing, you know, almost like on a stage, looking out over the Ridgeman Valley. And you kind of think that this film is actually about Ford's own sickness with violence. I mean, and not violence from the Westerns, but in fact, violence that he had seen himself. He worked a lot in propaganda films during World War II. So he had seen a lot of violence happen. So it's actually about John Ford's own kind of feelings, you know, that he wants to get away from violence. And, you know, and this dream world, which he created of Ireland, you know, this is the you know, this is where he wants to go. This Shangri-La, you know, that he wants to go to. But there's also the kind of ambiguity even when that, when he comes back, because he's a great realist director. And when he comes back to Ireland, the expectations aren't met. So it's almost like the bloody history from America's following him, and the fight at the end is almost like, you know, he brought this, you know, terrible kind of, you know, violence into Ireland. And, you know, it's almost about, you know, your bloody history following you. And I think it's actually about someone waking up to the way in which violence can kind of follow you around. Yeah, so I think it's a lot more ambiguous, and I would definitely advise you to go see Dreaming of a Quiet Man, whether online in the cinema or this Christmas when it's on TV. It's very interesting, and it's a lot really funny film as well, and there's some great anecdotes from Aaron O'Hara and a local character in Calm where it was filmed. So yeah, definitely if you're a fan of this movie, you know, definitely watch this film. But I would also advise you to see The Quiet Man if you haven't, because you've been put off by this reputation it has for being kind of corny. And also watch, you know, a lot of John Ford's other films, because there is, you know, this man is as great as Hitchcock or Howard Hawks or any of the great filmmakers of that from the early part of Hollywood. And he's definitely, you know, one of the giants of cinema, and he can't be just dismissed as a kind of a corny, hokey kind of director. So yeah, definitely watch this movie and a lot of his other films.
Climb so high, I never wanna die.
Okay, that was Born to be Wild, as we all know, and it was included in a very famous film from the 1960s we're going to talk to today, Easy Rider. Easy Rider, to me, is one of the films that actually changed not only the Hollywood, but indeed the world. And it is an incredible film, which, you know, often dismissed again, much like people often say that Bonnie and Clyde was actually the turning point in cinema. You know, that it actually brought more box office records, and it was an independent movie itself. And but I kind of don't think it is as giant as that, because, you know, Warren Beatty had actually a career before this, and, you know, he actually was a big enough name to kind of carry that movie. And also, people say that Monty Hellman's Two Lane Blacktop was a better, more extensionist road movie, and actually was expressed a lot more about the 60s. And as much as I love the film, I don't have as much impact and power, because it wasn't as successful. But also, I just don't think it's as big a movie that, you know, it's probably more interesting. But it's just not, it's never going to get to the same audience, and it's not going to reach, as it did with me, you know, teenagers at a certain period in their life and have as much impact on them. And I do think it is, that the reason that it does this, the reason it has kind of, you know, impressed me at that age and impresses, continues to impress people, is because it kind of expresses the 60s counterculture as fully as anybody in any medium. I mean, you know, if you, the only other, probably in cinema, is probably Woodstock, the only other, you know, I don't know, On the Road was written, you know, 20 years before that. You know, maybe Ken Casey, you know, to a certain extent got there with the Kool-Aid acid test. But I think the Easy Rider, you know, is the 60s, you know, in as much as the only other art form that actually expressed the 60s, you know, was the music. And I suppose it is the nearest equivalent to the music that was going on, or even an art, and like, you know, Lichtenstein or Warhol or any of these painters, they're not as impactful, or they don't really, you know, depict this great decade in American history as much as Easy Rider. But I mean, it's Hopper isn't, you know, a radical as much as his character in the film. And, you know, some of the politics are actually quite dubious. You know, to be honest with you, the heroes are drug dealers, which, you know, definitely puts them, you know, creates a kind of a negative view of the hippies. And also, the most charismatic character in the film is played by Jack Nicholson, who's a lawyer, who's kind of a conservative character. So it kind of praises and negates a lot of the 60s for a lot of people. But I don't know, behind all the drugs and sex and motorbikes, it's got an important message. You know, the scenes that really hold up for me, you know, and have a kind of a poetic quality are when they meet the farmers, and, you know, and then later on when they are in the commune, you know, and then they go swimming, and it's got a beautiful kind of simplicity to it, and a kind of almost like an Eden. And it shows that, I think that the fact that these two scenes are happening in the film, it shows that there was a kind of a new age hippie world that was kind of a throwback to a more innocent time, you know, in America, you know, before the consumerism. You know, there was these farmers who were kind of pre-lapsarian kind of, you know, and didn't have to like rely on, you know, capitalism. And I suppose that's really why I find that it's such an expressive and great film still. And then, you know, it really shows the redneck view of people that were outside society. And the famous inning is kind of a stark, you know, attack on a Republican America, you know, this you know, red state America that's, you know, tooth and claw against anybody who's any way weird or odd, or Democrat at the moment. But it's not just this really nasty ending, but it's the shooting and the editing, which were really revolutionary. And the famous way that Dennis Hopper would cut, you know, from one scene to another, where he would show a little bit of the next scene and then cut back to the previous scene and then finally let the scene flow on. You know, and this kind of reached its kind of, you know, pinnacle in the scene during Mardi Gras, where you see like beads and breasts floating around the place, and it's, you know, it's this kind of haphazard, you know, look and shooting style that he had. But this was because of the way Hopper worked, that he wasn't very good at kind of working with Peter Fonda, for instance, Dave Fell Out, when they're making this film. So, yeah, I mean, basically, Hopper brought the techniques of French cinema to America, you know, and for that, you know, we should be thankful that, you know, they brought all the kind of jump cutting and crazy editing styles. And I mean, I know later on that he went on to make a movie called The Last Movie, which is very underrated, and similarly has a kind of a crazy kind of feel to it. And, you know, and I think definitely was influential on a certain kind of underground filmmakers like Jabborsky, and his film El Topo was definitely, you know, due to kind of the filmmaking that Dennis Hopper was making. So, you know, it definitely changed the way cinema was working in America. And, you know, we can thank him, you know, in his book, Raging Bulls, Easy Rider's Raging Bulls. You know, it shows, Peter Biskin shows, you know, definitely how, you know, this movie changed cinema, changed the whole direction of cinema. Before that, cinema, you know, was all about kind of, you know, these big, huge productions in Hollywood, and now these smaller movies could get through, and these smaller voices could get through in the 70s. And this definitely wouldn't have happened without Easy Rider. And then, you know, the studios kind of broke down. He broke down the system of studios. So, you know, which was sadly destroyed then when Hollywood actors kind of came back and, you know, developed huge fees and the blockbuster generation came along. But for that brief period, from Easy Rider to Raging Bull, and Beast can kind of argue that this was, you know, definitely caused, you know, generation feelings were expressed. You know, in the best way, I think, since Hopper's screen debut in Rebel Without a Cause. You know, it definitely had that same similar kind of iconic impact. You know, and I think the most important thing he actually showed was the cruelty of Middle America to people in its, you know, any pioneers nowadays. I mean, that was a very, you know, kind of a dark thing to say, and you know, even in the 60s. But I think it also showed that the way beyond this kind of capitalistic kind of system were reflected in the values that it had forgotten, you know, before the kind of 1950s Truman America. So, you know, it was a very, very interesting, complex film. And, you know, it's still, you know, watched by students when they're stoned. But I think even now when I look back at it, I think there's a lot more to it than just this kind of, you know, thrill ride that it has going on. There is, you know, it's a very political film, a very mixed political film, mixed bag of goods politically. But, you know, also in its techniques, it was very important. And I think it had a very important thing to say to Middle America about itself. And then also it kind of showed that, you know, American cinema could do different things rather than just, you know, these big kind of productions, and that other voices could have a place in America and in society.
The river flows, it flows to the sea. Wherever that river goes, that's where I want to be. Flow, river, flow. Let your waters wash down. Take me from this road to some other town. All he wanted was to be free, and that's the way it turned out to be. Flow, river, flow, let your waters wash down, take me from this road to some other town. Flow, river, flow, past the shaded tree, go river, go, go to the sea. Flow to the sea. The river flows, it flows to the sea. Wherever that river goes, that's where I want to be. Flow, river, flow, let your waters wash down, take me from this road to some other town.
Yeah, there's Ballad of Easy Rider by the Birds, so I think, yeah, I can't leave without playing that. It's a great piece of music, and yeah, see you all next week. I hope you enjoyed this week's show, and I'll talk to you again next week. Okay, thank you, bye.
I came in here. I don't like these movies.
Well, I mean, I didn't know that you'd feel that way about this movie. I don't know much about movies, but if
you
know
what kind of movies you go to?
Well, yeah, I mean, I come and this is not so bad.